Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ethnographic Marginalia, a special series on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Navarapu.
And I'm Alex Diamond.
And we are the hosts of this special series.
Ethnographic Marginalia brings together a set of conversations around ethnographic practice. In each episode, we will converse with an ethnographer about their research design, process, and fieldwork experiences.
These conversations center the dilemmas, tribulations, mistakes, and pleasures that go into doing ethnographic research. We hope to use the conversations that transpire on this podcast as an opportunity to build community amongst ethnographers in various disciplines.
Towards this end, we also have a website where we publish field notes, ethnographic essays, photo essays, and methodological reflections.
Please visit our website, Ethnographic Marginalia, at www.ethnomarginalia.com to know more about how you can publish with us. We look forward to hearing from you.
Before we proceed with this episode, we'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Ethnography Incubator at the University of Chicago and the Lozano Long Institute of Latin American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin.
And so we begin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ethnographic Marginalia, a special series on the New Books Network. Today, Alex and I are so thrilled to be in conversation with Dr. Eli Wilson, the author of Front of the House, Back of the House, Race and Inequality in the Lives of Restaurant Workers, published by New York University Press in 2020. Dr. Eli Wilson is Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of New Mexico, and Alex and I are so honored to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, to both of you. This is really an honor, and I must say I love the theme of this show, so I'm really excited to be able to talk about the marginalia of the experience of doing ethnography.
Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, thank you, Eli. No, I was just going to say, even before we get into the marginalia, we like to start by hearing a little bit about your journey into becoming a sociologist, and also what interested you in ethnography specifically.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's see. I don't know what's distinctive or not so distinctive about my story versus others, but I came out of undergraduate at Wesleyan University, and I was a sociology major, so there was that tie-in. I also must say, my mother is a cultural anthropologist, so I always like to say that I was really playing on home turf. The idea of thinking deeply about social life, especially sort of those micro moments, those tensions, those curiosities. I mean, that was all stuff that I've heard in my ears since I was in high school, really, courtesy of my family. why ethnography specifically? I think it's hard to tell that story without talking about why I came to restaurants. I came to ethnography inductively. I mean, to use that word loosely, I was somebody who wanted to go into the restaurant industry, and possibly more specifically, I really wanted to work in craft beer. And that was my goal. That was my wide-eyed, you know, young 20-something goal, was to open a brew pub and work in restaurants and sling beer and you know, just, oh my gosh, it all seemed amazing when I was young. And that drove me to LA, where I had a couple cousins who really had that very same idea, but were a couple years older than me. And I worked at their restaurant and really kind of fast forward a year, possibly more. And I was, you know, I came to restaurants, and by way of restaurants, I rediscovered ethnography and sociology more broadly, just absolutely was fascinated by what I saw. It was a world unto itself, as I'm sure we'll talk more about, that is being, you know, being and you know, inhabiting restaurants very fully. And that drove me, you know, got my mind turning again. It got me thinking about questions that, in my mind, only ethnography is equipped to answer.
Yeah. I mean, just to go on the same tangent, the book is an exploration of two unequal labor worlds, so to speak, that are enclosed within the upscale restaurant scene in LA. Using ethnography, you study the persisting inequalities between two groups that both work at the restaurant, the white college-educated server group who operate in the front of the house, and Latino immigrants who work at the back and are completely out of customer view. We particularly loved how you said that you intend this book to stand out or stand as an empirically grounded account of how service work and social inequality come to be intertwined in ways that go largely unnoticed by the people who patronize these establishments. We both certainly can never look at a restaurant the same way again. So thank you for writing this really important book.
Oh, but, gosh. You know, yeah. I was going to say, it's just my pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, you already spoke a little bit about how ethnography is intertwined with you starting your own restaurant or working at restaurants. But how did this become like a full-fledged research project?
Yeah. Well, you know, kind of picking up what I was previously saying, I think that the kernel of my thinking about the book came well before fieldwork was something that I had in mind, and frankly, well before I was ever formally enrolled in another sociology program, which of course was at UCLA. But it really came from this driving, almost nagging question, which was, you know, I knew restaurants and I knew maybe, you know, beer and bars more specifically. I knew that from the point of view of customers and from my own passions for sort of consuming and participating within that space. What I didn't know was what went on behind the scenes. So working in restaurants gave me a glimpse into that world. And, you know, while I was aware from doing some other, I might have been, you know, curious and aware of what that was like in the front of house. That is, you know, directly interfacing with customers, guests. I had no idea what went on even deeper within that world, and that is in relation to back of house and more invisible spaces. I mean, just really tracing service, going backwards and further back until you get to places that start. You know, you know, the language starts to change, the music starts to change, right? The color of people's skin start to change, something I talk about. And that started to fascinate me. And those kinds of divides that are lived, points of tension, sometimes points of joy and laughter. But ultimately, you know, what I came to understand as the stuff, you know, the meat of inequality. That's the stuff that was, those were questions well before I ever went back into grad school.
So in the book, you talk about three different restaurants, and actually you harness a comparison of the three. These are all upscale, relatively upscale restaurants in Los Angeles, but they have kind of different brands. And in fact, this branding is part of the allure, and especially in the front of the house, is kind of figures into manager decisions about who to hire, which is crucial to your analysis. And we can talk more about that. But we're interested, like, it, I think I gathered that at one of those restaurants you were working in before starting graduate school. Is that right? And then also, like, how did you make the decision to work in three different restaurants, and how did you choose these restaurants?
Yeah, well, I guess to set the record straight on that point, Alex, I wasn't actually, all three of these restaurants began, you know, kind of coincided with my journey in graduate school. It's complicated because I think the story, you know, the arc of the story that I was just recounting, I worked in, oh gosh, three restaurants prior to beginning fieldwork. So there's an interesting sort of three and three. Yeah, but there was actually a fairly delineated break between sort of my pre-graduate school restaurant experience, just being in the industry full time, and then post. So anyway, you asked about how did I come to the decision of those three. You know, I think everything happened. Everything happened from the ground up. You know, none of this was preconceived. I really, you know, I entered the field driven to explore maybe one restaurant. I'm just trying to put myself in the mind frame back in, oh gosh, 2011 and 12 when I'm thinking about this. I really wanted to just dig into one restaurant. And I knew that... I at the time I was reading some books, some really fantastic books, Greta Fofpala's, I might be mispronouncing her last name. I was thinking about Gary Allen Fine's Kitchens. I was thinking about, Barbara Ehrenreich, you know, her, when she's, you know, when she's working within that really, kind of, I don't want to call it, well, maybe dingy, a little bit lower end, you know, kind of diner. So I was reading that kind of literature and I was thinking, okay, well, what would be a different angle? And simultaneously, I was thinking about my own experience and thinking, what would push me? And I think what interested me the most was really penetrating into more higher end spaces, more spaces of luxury, spaces that were hard to access. They were hard to access as a customer because of the financial resources involved. And you know, sort of that cultural capital that you need to kind of embody to know how to operate in that space. But I think also as an ethnographer, what would push me to reach for something that I don't know, take the assets that I have and reach for something beyond. And for me, that was working, you know, in service in spaces that cared about service, right? This is not a space where it was just, oh, slinging hamburgers and, you know, yeah, I'll take another order of fries. Absolutely not. It was service as an experience. And that experience was the stuff I wanted to really uncover.
Yeah. And, you know, the book hinges, as I mentioned before, on the comparison between workers in the front of the house and workers in the back of the house. But it seems like your actual participation as a worker was mostly in the front of the house. So we were curious to know how this affected your understanding of the dynamics of the restaurants and what you did as part of your fieldwork to try to get as close as possible to the back of the house experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great insight. It's certainly nothing that I hide. My point of access as an ethnographer, and you know, I talk a lot about the fact that this comes from my social characteristics. As a white appearing, you know, upper middle class, college educated man. Those are characteristics, of course, something I talk a lot about in the book, but those characteristics were the norm rather than the exception working in the front of house, which may come to a surprise to some, maybe not all, you know, the fact that those from a degree of privilege are actually the norm within these spaces. You know, upscale restaurants are not settings where, you know, it's the typical, you know, this sort of trope of a, you know, kind of, you know, low wage worker, limited education, you know, relative sources of underprivileged population. That's not the case. I mean, that's certainly the case in the industry abroad, but less so in the kinds of settings that I was maybe most interested in. So anyway, that was my point of access, and I certainly don't try to hide that. And I absolutely agree with you that shaped my view of restaurants. I was seeing the restaurant primarily from that point of view, and sort of looking outward, looking at management from that point of view, looking at guests and customers. I'm so trained to say guests that I remember that sort of categorically we're talking about customers here. And then certainly looking at back of house, looking at the kitchen and looking at the spaces deeper within that setting, but really looking mostly from the perspective of you know, being physically and also socially part of the front of the house. So to your question about how did I bridge some of that data collection? I think that's a great point. And it's something that as the project developed, I became more and more aware of. And I say that because in full honesty, I was not so aware of that as I began the project. I was so invested in, you know, becoming a part of this space, developing rapport, developing a deep understanding of what it was like to do my job, within this kind of setting. And so it was something that I came to a little bit later. And once it became important, increasingly important to me to have to want to know the world of the back of house more, that was the time in which I actually changed my behavior within restaurants. I started spending breaks, for instance, with cooks, which, by the way, made me, raise more than a few quizzical eyebrows amongst my, white, young, trend-setting, shall I say, front of house colleagues. I would sit with cooks. I would sit with the Latino cooks. I would have breaks with them. I would share food with them. I would listen to their stories. Restaurants, something I probably don't pay as much attention to in the narrative of the book, but there's a lot of downtime, right? Everyone pays attention to the height of the rush, right? Which is this really, really heady moment of pressure. I used to have nightmares about being what's called in the weeds. Oh my goodness, just forgetting orders and 10 things to do at once and only time for one of them. Anyway, but I think relevant to your question is spending downtime, spending breaks, spending time after I had clocked out or before I had clocked in spaces that were more sort of symbolically and spatially associated with the back of house. Kitchens, dishwashing stations, even, one of the three restaurants had a lower floor. Which is an interesting, sort of symbolism, but had a lower floor where the cleaning staff would primarily operate. This is where linens got washed and aprons got folded and, sort of returned so that the chefs could pick them up the next day. Well, anyway, that was a space where, more of the Latina and even Latina and Latino staff was located, where they would spend a lot of time. And it became important to me to volunteer to be the one to go down there and to spend more time. So that was really a conscious decision that I made, precisely because my inn was not in the kitchen. And frankly, for the life of me, I could not figure out how to let management let me spend labor time operating the kitchen, doing the work of line work, who were far more talented and skilled at doing that than I was.
Yeah.
So what you just said was really interesting. And I think we might have a bunch of follow-up questions, but I want to zero in on one particular thing you said, which is that your coworkers sort of thought it was strange. Your front of the house coworkers, I should say, thought it was strange that you were spending time with back of the house people, which is really telling about something that you describe beautifully as these two different, very separate worlds where people who work together for long, long periods of time, share what seems like one space, end up not even knowing each other's names, just something specific that you described. So reading that, I thought it was an excellent example of something that we talk about a lot as ethnographers, which is not, that you got this job so you could be a fly on the wall and just observe, this same point would apply to many of our projects, but that our very presence is productive of data. So I also thought about like your story in the introduction or the preface, I forget, but kind of how you opened the book, which is that you were promoted. You were in a position that was sort of in between front of the house and back of the house. And I'm actually forgetting what the position is called, but a position with less interaction with customers, with less financial rewards, right? And you were promoted to be a bartender. And this is, you said yourself, modestly, you said that your coworkers were more capable than you in sort of the work of, getting food out to people, picking up dirty dishes, all of that stuff. But that it was your identity, which you've also talked about, that was the reason that you were promoted. So this is a sort of a long preface to a question, which I'd just like you to go into a little more depth and how the experiences that you had, you know, not just what you observed, but your presence in the field, how that was important to the conclusions you draw and people's reaction to you.
Absolutely. You know, I think a lot of ethnographers talk about the embodied dimension of fieldwork. I think that's not news by any means. And I certainly would fully concur that a lot of my best data came from that, you know, day in and day out grind and reflecting on that grind. And of course, you know, kind of mining my own thoughts as well as my interactions with others, the tiredness in my feet after a double shift, that is where you work two shifts in a row, sometimes upwards of 10, 12 hours. These kind of things I think it's the bread and butter of any good ethnography, to think about that and to use that as data and frankly, to use that as a springboard for more insights. So I totally believe in that. You know, I think the situation that I recount in the preface, which actually predates my formal fieldwork, this was really about finding the kernel of my interest in this project. I think that really reveals the way that those embodied, you know, experiences of doing and then thinking about what you're doing are generative of questions. And that more than anything was what that experience really meant to me. It was being confused and firsthand about why me? I don't know if that exact expression made it into the book, this question of why me? But I can tell you, it was something that I was thinking about at night. It was something that I was thinking about as I walked in the door, and it was something that I was, frankly, in the back of my mind when I was interacting with the very people who looked different than me. When I would have to look them in the eye and reflect on why me and why not you, being promoted to a position that at the time, you know, as someone in that position, it was a huge economic leap to work behind the bar as opposed to what's called running food or food running. Massive, we're talking nearly twice as much in tips. So it's no small gesture. It's no small subtle distinction within the labor world of restaurants to make that leap. It's a categorical leap. And frankly, you know, as I recount over and over in the book, it's a social and symbolic, leap across that divide as well.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and you know, we were very intrigued by your discussions of how workplace marginalization and worker mobility are interlinked. And this, for us, was a precise example of how certain structural logics that escape notice, unless afforded the keen attention that ethnography equips us with how that works, you know, that kind of illumination. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about why some of the Latino workers you spent time with were able to secure better quality jobs and why some others were not?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I love that insight, because I think it shows the power of ethnography, as you alluded to, Sneha. In that, you know, the world on the ground, a lot of these things that we find are complicated. And some of the best insights come from taking serious, I guess what would be formally known as deviant cases. But you know, I don't know. That always sounds too formulaic. I simply mean, in my context, paying attention to who amongst the Latino workers in restaurants did seem to be getting ahead, and maybe why. And getting ahead, you know, I like this expression, but I recognize that it's vague, and I think it takes two distinct forms, at least within the world of restaurants and the hierarchies that are apparent there. The first would be being promoted to the service staff and moving from a invisible position, doing busing work or just food running, where one is not really expected to talk with customers, really just shuttle food, which I call support work in the book, precisely for that reason. But moving to a more visible front of house role, making that kind of leap, being promoted to that status. So that's one type of getting ahead. And that's getting ahead for financial reasons, but it also opens a variety of doors that differ from being stuck in the kitchen or in support roles. The second kind of getting ahead that I think is of interest here is moving up the kitchen ladder to roles of prominence within that space, to roles of authority, small movements of getting paid more, having more responsibility within the kitchen. And that's a very meaningful kind of promotion and advancement, especially to cooks. And so there were these two simultaneous ways in which I conceived of getting ahead more broadly. And I really became fascinated by the kind of workers that seem to be able to make those moves. Now, one thing that I talk about, I talk about some of the advantages of being, of exhibiting or inhabit or embodying in-betweenness. And that's sort of the term I came to use. It just seemed like it made the most sense. And what I mean by in-betweenness is it was simultaneously drawing on the tacit skills developed, of working hard, running food well, knowing how to carry plates. I'm talking about support work, knowing how to sort of navigate the space well, and in the kitchen, the same kind of thing, knowing how to chop faster, knowing how to multitask, knowing how to time dishes. But I in-betweenness also captured a social dimension. It was being able to communicate with, in Spanish and sort of within the cultural world, deeply informed by Latino, and I would also say male culture, in the kitchen and also in support jobs. So being able to communicate and be present within that space, and then also being able to code switch, socially and culturally, and communicate with the white servers, with the white managers, with the white male chefs, And that became a crucial source of advantage. And the way I conceived of it, it became a primary way that that some of the some of the Latino workers in restaurants were able to get ahead and also leapfrog some of their other coworkers who were less able to do that very same sort of skill, that skill of in-betweenness. Now, the last thing I'll say, I'm sorry I've been being a little long-winded here.
No, please. This is really interesting.
Oh, yeah. The last thing I'll say about that that became super interesting to me was how some of the characteristics of in-betweenness were predicated on the relative lack of that same characteristic amongst other kinds of Latino colleagues. So such that, you know, the source of one's advantage is premised in part on the, sort of the embeddedness, the stuckedness, if you will, of another cohort of Latino workers in positions that were, that they were mired within. They were not getting ahead. They were stuck as, say, dishwashers, really low paid dishwashers who had been doing this for years, sometimes decades, without a single promotion, and also working as members of the cleaning staff. And when I started to recognize that there was a distinction between those that were accelerating ahead and those who were stuck behind, or stuck really deep in to use an evocative metaphor, in the bowels of restaurants, in the closets, in the back closets of restaurants, and that's a term I use, that became a fascinating way to think about some of the sources of advantage and further barriers of exclusion within the sort of Latino back of the house in restaurants.
I think that was really, really telling and interesting about sort of the nature of, how we think about identity, and not as sociologists, as people, as members of society, identity and race and ethnicity, and what kind of people were able to have that in-betweenness and whatnot. I really enjoyed your analysis of that. But I want to go back to in-betweenness as an ethnographer, which you talked about your efforts to engage back of the house people. And that your coworkers thought it was a little strange, which for me raises the question, did people know what you were doing in the restaurant? That you weren't just waiting tables and trying to make friends to go hang out with after work, but your research project. So how did you explain that to coworkers, both in the front and the back of the house?
Yeah, so that's always, that's always an important question. And sometimes, this was a project where I didn't, very strategically, I did not come in, with a student card, flashing my student card, flashing my, ethnographer or sociologist card, and asking, okay, well, could you let me have a job here? For strategic reasons, I did all of my job search and, initial kind of integration within this workplace, without prior knowledge of either management or my coworkers of what I was doing. That was, of course, something that I had to reveal, after I had established that initial rapport. That was always part of my strategy. That was always my intention. And I, at each restaurant, I had speaking about my relationship with management, I was a worker first and a sociologist and an ethnographer second. And so I had those conversations with management, sat them down, told them a little bit about my project, sort of strategically played up, played down, the gravity of what I was doing, in the sense that I made sure to convey I was a student, which was absolutely true. I was a graduate student. I was doing a project. I was doing a project on what it's like to work in restaurants. And that was all true. I mean, probably understated, some of what I was going, what was really occurring. But it was, in my opinion, that helped them feel at ease with what I was doing and be open to not changing their behavior towards me or thinking different. Now, in terms of my relationship with workers, those conversations emerged more organically, especially with my colleagues in the front of the house. It became similarly. It became, hey, you know, I'm doing this project on restaurant work. I'm thinking about what we do every day, and I'm taking notes. And frankly, they were very receptive to this. They were some of them were, they thought it was really cool that this stuff could be in a book one day. I think there was always that inevitable awkwardness at first, like, oh, you know, gosh, should I or should I not tell Eli, you know, something or behave differently? But that stuff resolved itself very quickly. I think it's because I was a worker first. I was somebody who established, I was there to work hard. I had gone through the same training and orientation, and I had fell on my face just as they had. So that was really important to me. You know, and in the kitchen, I really think it was an extension of that. It became, I'll tell you, just to nuance it a little bit further, I think I really leaned on my contacts, some key contacts in the kitchen, to kind of get my foot in the door to the space that I was not fully present, you know, really a full member of, you know, not being hired in the kitchen, and certainly talking different, looking different from those individuals. So what I mean by that, and this goes to an earlier question that I think, Alex, that you raised, it became really important to me to establish some key informants, some key people that I was following in the kitchen. These people tended to be, I'll tell you the first trait, they tended to be bilingual and fluently bilingual. Because, you know, in full disclosure, I'm not proficient in Spanish. I picked up functional Spanish that could serve me well in a kitchen space, you know, kind of crude kitchen space for understanding. But I lean heavily on bilingual participants. And some of them were immigrants who, you know, had in over the course of their time working in this country had learned English. Others were second generation, you know, born and raised in LA. And I really befriended them and had a kind of a deep relationship with some of them, would go out after work, would hang out on breaks with these individuals. And they became really crucial for me to help me understand that space and to help people in the kitchen be more comfortable with what I was doing. And I mean that as a researcher, writing a book ultimately interviewing them, spending time with them that I would record. And so all of that kind of emerged over time rather than sort of upfront and really formal.
Did you get any resistance? I guess just for our listeners who haven't read the book, which they should because it's excellent. but you know, you write that there's sort of a, I don't know if rivalry is the right word, but there's these two very separate social worlds, front of the house, back of the house. And there's, I guess, problems of translation. There's resentment between the two worlds. I could see that you might potentially get some resistance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point, Alex. And I try in the book to be as transparent as I can about how I manage that, because you're certainly right. Just to reiterate, it is not normal. It is not typical for somebody, especially somebody who looks like me, to be spending that much time, you know, with people in the back of house, and to be frankly that interested in, what goes on, interested in their lives, and also what goes on in the back of the house, in the kitchen, and so on and so forth. I think on one hand, to your point, I think that does raise very real questions about tension that might have caused. And I think in the book, I do talk a little bit about some moments where my presence as somebody primarily in the front of house, and some of the things that were just typical of the front of house, for instance, tips. I I receive tips just like every other server and bartender and host and to some extent food runner and busser. That tips were very much, a huge part of what it means to work in that space. The kitchen workers didn't. And that's something I talk a lot and I've thought a lot about. Well, anyway, there were moments where, as you might imagine, those tips became, are a source of major contention between front and back of house. And the fact that I received tips and they didn't, including people that I consider friends, kitchen workers, that was certainly something that I think was a thorn in our relationship at times and was difficult to navigate for me, to be honest. I think at the same time, so again, the tension was certainly there. I will also say, though, that ironically, because there is such a divide between these worker cohorts, sometimes small acts go a long way. And that may seem kind of quaint to point out, but I'll tell you what I mean by that. I found that precisely because there was this kind of mutual ignorance and tension that sort of was kind of, I don't know, sometimes the air was thick in between the kitchen staff and the front of house. The conversations were different. The things that were muttered sometimes about each other were different because of all that. Just the fact that I was making concerted efforts to get to know people in the back of house, my Latino colleagues back there, the fact that I would hang out with them, I'd sneak them sodas, and I'd sneak them sometimes even beers. I hope my old managers aren't listening right now, but we would do this because I saw how hard they were working, especially as I got to know their story. And I think that these small gestures, I don't want to overblow this, but I think that they were meaningful. And as a small example of that, in every restaurant that I worked at, I got a nickname. I got a nickname from my Latino workers who were, the cooks and the dishwashers. They gave me a name that they would call me, a pet name. And I say that, and again, I understand that this may sound really quaint, but I was one of the only members of the front of house that got that nickname. And of course they all had nicknames, for each other, but I was nicknamed things like leche, milk in Spanish. I mean, really they would call me milk, and yes, it has racial undertones, but it was a joking matter, right? It was, hey, leche's here again, let's slap hands and talk story for a little bit. And that occurred in every single, it wasn't the same nickname, but this pattern was something that was important for me to establish. It was a sign that I had gained a kind of liminal membership and, dare I say, friendship with these individuals. And all of that, I can't emphasize enough, was so different from how they related to their other coworkers, many of whom they did not even know by name, right? It became that they would come to me and ask, hey, can you flag down that blonde girl in the glasses, right? Or, and sometimes it'd be very crude, right? It'd be, hey, tell the fat server that he's got to, slow down his orders. We're getting killed back here. It would be relaying that to me because of, I think, my kind of position that I very deliberately, that I very meaningfully tried to establish. And that became, one way in which I think I use some of these differences, apparent differences, maybe to my advantage a little bit, as a source of data collection and kind of liminal insider status.
Mm-hmm. Well, in more practical terms, I guess, related to what you were talking about. So when you were working and having these interactions, were you taking down field notes on the go, or were you going home and writing everything down? What was your, I guess, your practical modus operandi? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm afraid I don't have any profound insight on this front, Sneha. I tried to carry a notebook as was recommended, you know, as I was kind of saddling up to do field work and I was sitting in classes at UCLA on you know, best practices, I definitely intended that. I can say that that quickly didn't work. Life in restaurants happens so fast. And I had my hands absolutely full being, a full-time restaurant worker. I was on stage, you know, as Goffman might say, I was on stage, not just to my coworkers and managers, but I was also on stage to customers. And I could not find, for the life of me, a time to, make sense of taking notes sort of in the moment. What became really, really important to me was to take notes immediately afterwards. This was many long nights, staying up, forcing myself to not go to bed, after a night shift until 1-2 in the morning, until I had collected my thoughts on what had occurred that day. While I think that that's fairly typical, a resolution of how best to capture the ethnographic world, and to do so by typing up field notes afterwards, that was absolutely true of my experience.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. that sort of the moment when you finish field work and you're going home or to a cafe or whatever, and you think about everything that's just happened and everything that you need to write down, mm-hmm. Is something that I think a lot of ethnographers can relate to.
Absolutely.
So speaking of relatable things, we're just sort of generally interested in the kind of dilemmas that ethnographers face and eventually we hope resolve. So was there any moments that you would identify from your field work where you were maybe concerned about something, not sure if you would be able to continue, any interruptions? Mm. And how did you resolve these issues?
Well, let me point out three, and I'll focus on the last one because I think it's probably the most novel. The first one I'd say is the practical consideration that ethical consideration as well, that I was an employee and I, wasn't at liberty to kind of do the fly on the wall thing that other ethnographers are able to do because they're not an employee. And maybe the most apt comparison here would be to Gary Allen Fine, who, he has a wonderful book, a huge inspiration to me called Kitchens. I was certainly reading that. But something of note here is that he was the fly on the wall. He was somebody who, petitioned management, I don't know the exact details, to basically observe kitchen workers. And I think he has some somewhat humorous stories of being allowed to kind of volunteer in the kitchen and attempt to do, to fit into the flow of what cooks do. I think he fully recounts how challenging that was. So I wasn't able to do that. I was a worker and an employee and had managers evaluating me as such. And so, I had to take that seriously. And sometimes even when I knew that there was great data to be had, there was the table that needed another refill of wine, beer, maybe even water. That was my job. And that is where my attention had to, by necessity, go. So there's that. The second ethical dilemma I alluded to earlier, which was recognizing that that there was such disparity, both within the structure of restaurants in terms of who was earning what money, and how, and something that I still find disturbing to this day is the fact that we in the front of the house, and myself included, because of my position, we were making, I would say, three times, sometimes four times more per hour than our back of house colleagues. That disparity blew my mind. It became something that I was deeply troubled by. But was nonetheless a reality experienced by every single person who works in restaurants. We did not share tips by the structure of the restaurant with the back of house. In fact, there was, until very recently, there were laws against that, which always are astounding to me. Tips can only be served. That's a whole other conversation. But needless to say, at the time I was in restaurants, tips were what that was the jurisdiction and the monies of people working in the front of house. And so that was a source of tremendous tension, interpersonal tension. As I mentioned, you know, sometimes cooks looking on at these gaudy bills being passed back and forth among servers and bartenders that they did not have access to. But also it was a tremendous source of ethical qualm for me. Should I, for instance, be handing some of that, you know, go out of my way, breaking with restaurant norm and tradition to be handing them some of that money, redistributing it on my own, you know, accord. And I was torn about this. It was something ultimately I did not do in that formal sense of like handing them bills as if tipping them or really what's known as tipping out people, precisely because that was not just the norm, but that was also not part of the tip rules within restaurants. I will say that wherever possible, you know, I tried to go out of my way to make gestures to buy them beers after shift, bring in sometimes beers and small treats that would for them. You know, so I did not, again, it was my somewhat, it was my personal way of resolving my own, you know, moral and ethical qualms than anything, but that was something that I chose to do. Let me just point out the third, probably most interesting ethical or just kind of fieldwork dilemma that I experienced. And that was at the second restaurant that I was employed at and that I spent time within. This was a restaurant called Terroir. And at Terroir, which I do say in the book, was actually the highest end restaurant in many ways, the setting of the most explicit, you know, traditional luxury. The restaurant went through a period while I was there where it wasn't doing very well. And I, you know, I don't include these details because I thought that they would be distracting for the ultimate narrative, which was one of a worker dynamic, you know, and so on and so forth. But in terms of fieldwork, this restaurant was really struggling. And it came to the point that it was getting very uncomfortable to be there. To be there every day because there was just no money to go around. Now that may seem only loosely connected, but let me explain how that manifested in very real ways. There was no tips to go around, and there became these internal squabbles between front of house staff about, you know, jockeying for tables, meaning really jockeying for who was going to make tips that day. And, you know, it became this incredible source of tension. Also, just the mood in the front of the house became absolute poison. It became, instead of camaraderie and, you know, this jovial sense of, oh, gosh, you know, we're having fun, we're goofing around, all that. It became daggers. It became, you know, why aren't you helping me more? You know, take care of this table. You know, why did you do this? Why didn't you share, you know, tips? In this way, I'm going, you know, I'm going to storm off and you do all the side work. I deserve to leave. You know, it became people quitting outright. It became people bad mouthing the restaurant, the management, the coworkers, the kitchen staff. And I saw some of that also manifesting amongst the cooks who are used to working hard and always being in motion. And all of a sudden, there was not much to do. For you know, shifts on end, in weeks on end. And I think the dilemma that raised for me was I was seeing my coworkers just quit outright. And I also saw management start leaning on me as a worker more and more, even knowing I was doing research, you know, saying, hey, can you come in? You know, and really there was a pleading quality to their voice, like, hey, you're one of the few people that seems to come in here, smile on their face, wants to work hard. We need you. We need you every shift. Come in. Can you come in 6 days a week? Can you stay for a double? These questions were posed to me precisely because I wanted, you know, I was willing to work hard to be there, but ultimately the subtext is the reason I wanted to be there was because I was also a researcher, right? I needed to be there. I needed to collect that data. I needed to experience that setting. But that was also, you know, had an interesting kind of strange bedfellow effect that management leaned on that, you know, almost, I guess one could use the word exploited that even more to have me come in more and more and more. And eventually I had to say no. I had to say, hey, you know, I gotta hold this at bay, you know, five shifts a week. That's a lot. I'm a full-time student, you know? So yeah, that became a source of tension.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I can only imagine trying to hold down a job like that while also being in graduate school. So to shift quickly, as we finish up, we were really curious to know what ethnographic texts inspired you, as you were doing field work and writing even.
Yeah. So, you know, I, when you kind of posed that question to me kind of before we got started on the air, I will say that a major source of my inspiration was seeing more senior, deeply committed ethnographers within my graduate program at UCLA. And in particular, I'm thinking about David Truey, who I believe you spoke with a few weeks back for this very podcast. You know, and he's not the only one by any means. Forrest Stewart was another tremendous inspiration, but just seeing them go through the critical steps of ethnography, right? And asking questions about their field sites. We used to have working group meetings where they would bring real live data and watching them grapple with it, right? Almost with a twinkle in their eye. I mean, it's pretty easy for me to romanticize those early moments, just being in the same room with you know, these scholars who are a little bit more my senior, when I, especially in my formative years as a developing ethnographer, and just seeing their process, right, being an insider to their world as ethnographers, and the way they connected to theory, the way they asked questions, the way they let their curiosity guide them, and I'm so happy for them that all of their books are published. You know, Forrest has won awards, and I'm sure others will follow. So that was something that really stuck with me. So, you know, for those of you listening who are graduate students, I hope that you have a lively, you know, thriving community of ethnographers, and I don't just mean your professor mentors. I really do mean fellow colleagues in graduate school. So there's certainly that. In terms of actual text, the one that really stands out to me is Rachel Sherman's Class Acts. I absolutely adored that book, especially when I was in the field. And I love the detail she captured. And of course, that book is about hotel work, luxury hotel work. And so, you know, there was certainly some resonance in terms of the empirical detail. But I also loved how she was able to capture that world, both as a worker in that space, and, you know, also those moments where she was using dialogue to tell stories. She was recounting different workers who had different experiences. So, you know, Class Acts was a major inspiration on that front.
Yeah, that's, I was just taking down some notes as you were speaking about proposing some kind of like ethnography grad student thing at UChicago as well. So thanks for that, had to bend. Yeah, Rachel Sherman's Class Acts is really, really classic. So glad it got this shout out. Before we let you go, and we've taken up a lot of your time, we would really love to know, what are you working on right now, and what can we expect to read by you in the future?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, after the years and years of, you know, being in the thick of restaurant, you know, working in restaurants, and then my goodness, just the multi-year process of turning that into a book, which you know, is something I'm so proud of, and also equally willing to recognize just how long an endeavor that was. You know, about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago at this point, I did get started with a new project. It was a project that emerged, I think, fairly seamlessly from you know, what I was thinking about in restaurants, and frankly, some of the same context, which is I recognize that not everyone's able to do. And that is, I really became fascinated with the world of craft beer. And I really shouldn't act like I should be so surprised here. This was one of my first loves, you know, as I was coming out of being an undergrad. But I became super interested in, you know, this incredible explosion of interest in craft beer, in artisanship, in craft making. And I became interested in it not as a consumer, although I certainly am that and have been for some time. Some might even call me a beer geek, and I would accept that, you know, sort of knowingly. But that's not the focus of this research. I'm really focused on the labor of craft work, and more specifically craft beer, and doing the same kind of gesture that I kind of you know, was thinking through both empirically and theoretically in the restaurant project, which is going further and further behind the scenes, seeing interconnected actors along this, you know, what Anselm Strauss would call this arc of labor. You know, the various hands that end up touching, that go into creating craft beer, many of which will never gain accolades for doing so, and are well beyond the world of beer geeks and people who love and care and participate in the world of consuming beer. So, you know, and I wanted to explore that as an ethnographer, spend time in brew houses and just hang out in that classic ethnographic sense with people who are brewing beer, and see how they talk about it, see how they use their hands to make it, see, you know, be a part of that ambiance. What's, you know, the oftentimes heavy metal blaring in the background as, you know, as tattooed, you know, bearded white men throw 55-pound bags of malt into the mash tun. You know, these are fascinating to me, and they bring up, of course, really compelling questions about race, about culture, about identity, and all threaded together within this this world of work. So anyway, craft beer is my current project, and I hope to bring this kind of richness.
What's that? You have a captive audience in me already. So,
well, thank you. It's ongoing, but I'm really excited. And again, it was what I view as a fairly natural outgrowth from my time in restaurants.
Well, Eli, this project sounds fascinating. We'll look forward to reading for that your work from that research project as well. And want to thank you for coming on and really congratulate you on a wonderful book, which for our listeners is Front of the House, Back of the House: Race and Inequality in the Lives of Restaurant Workers, by Eli Wilson. And yeah, it was great to have you on and sort of hear a little bit about the back of the house of your ethnographic practice. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, you know, both to Alex and Snail for this opportunity. You know, it's not often that some really, really thoughtful questions get posed my way about the process of ethnography, not only the substance, the theoretical and empirical substance. So really, thank you for taking the time to read this book and for, you know, for your really thoughtful engagement with it.
Thank you for coming on. And yeah, take care and stay safe.
Will do. You as well.